You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham, Alabama, a church with a heart for the gospel. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.
Well, thank y'all for being here. I know we're all running a little behind on timing after the service, but I think probably best to go ahead and get started in case anybody's headed to 11. I don't want to make anybody late. But thank you all so much for being here today. For those of you who weren't here last time, I'm Daryl McDavid. My husband, Will, is a seminarian at Beeson. And this is actually the second of a three-part class. So the audio for the first class is on the website if you're a glutton for punishment and want to go back to listen to some more. And then the third and final class will actually be the week after Easter. So we'll skip a week and then be back here in the living room again. I spoke in the last class about how the stories of the seven barren women in the Bible have been, for me, as the psalmist says, a picture of God's goodness in the land of the living, but also a window into how God uses his women, even and perhaps especially the most broken of us, as key players in his redemptive plan. Between our first son, Ben, and our second son, John, Will and I suffered 6 miscarriages in the course of 24 months. We eventually did have a successful IVF experience and conceived our son, John, who was born last February. But as I've talked with friends and family over the years, I've begun to realize just how prevalent this curse of what we call, at least in modern America, fertility issues is. The doctors were never able to give me an explanation for why this kept happening to me, other than recurrent miscarriages, which is less a diagnosis and more a description of years of my life. Doctor's appointments, blood work, progesterone, perimetrium, baby aspirins, and then the cramps, the bleeding, the in-office procedure or the DNC, the Cytotec, the advice to take some time, wait a bit, try again in a few months, the ultrasound pictures I still have of babies who were never born that are tucked in the back of a drawer in my desk because I don't know what to do with them. In the last class, I spoke about how our modern words for fertility issues, miscarriages, infertility, sterility, are used to divide us from each other, to separate our stories into all these boxes, as if we can't relate to each other because we're experiencing such different versions of disappointment and loss. While I don't want to deny that there is a truth that we all experience our pain with a kind of horrible uniqueness, there's also so much hope I have found in knowing that we weren't alone as a couple, as a family, trying so hard to have children and meeting nothing but disappointment and death around every corner. And when I turned to the Bible, I felt an overwhelming sense of relief to find the stories of these seven women, their pain and anguish and emptiness, which in the end were no match for God's intervening salvific resurrection power. Lord, what good news it was and continues to be for me, and my prayer today is that it will be for you as well. There's no division in the Hebrew for issues of fertility. The Old Testament word is akar, which at its root means to be plucked up. As we saw in the last class, the verb form is used in this passage from Ecclesiastes, a time to pluck up what is planted. When the women in the Bible are described as akar, it means they could have never gotten pregnant, but it also means that they could have conceived and that whatever was planted in their wombs was plucked out. I use the term barrenness for our class as a kind of English shorthand, but I love the way that the biblical word brings women together in their sorrow rather than driving us apart by differing diagnoses. Last class, we looked at the barrenness of the three matriarchs in the book of Genesis. Sarah, who eventually gives birth to Isaac after 25 years, Rebecca, who waits 20 years to conceive Jacob and Esau, and Rachel, who spends 14 years in bitter competition with her own sister, who finally gives birth to Joseph, and who some years later dies giving birth to Benjamin. We looked at similarities in their stories from the birth of what scholars call the heroic child to the threatened loss of that promised child. We will see this even more vividly today. We looked at the ways the barren wife is often placed in competition with a fertile co-wife, and how the first words that our women speak are often about their childlessness. We looked at the betrothal scenes at the well of both Rebecca and Rachel, and at several thematic words and phrases that we'll see repeated in these future stories. These are messy stories of the pain of barrenness, but also of families collapsing, of exile and sorrow and death beyond the miraculous birth. God has used three barren women to create the nation of Israel, but this is not the end of his work. So let's turn to our first woman for today, the wife of Manoah. The story of the wife of Manoah is told in chapter 13 of the book of Judges. A quick overview, Judges covers the period of Israel's history between the conquest of the Promised Land under Joshua to the entrance of Samuel, who will inaugurate the monarchy. There's a pattern throughout Judges where Israel departs from God, he delivers them into the hands of their enemies, here the Philistines, Israel cries out for aid, and God raises up a judge to champion them. Chapter 13 is the story of the final champion in the book, Samson. Chapter 13 opens with the statement that the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and he delivered them into the hands of the Philistines for 40 years. 40 years. That's as long as the Israelites wandered in the desert. Strong's Hebrew notes that 40 marks eras of testing and judgment. Think 40 days of flood, 40 days Moses spends on Sinai, 40 days that Goliath taunts Israel, 40 days Jesus spends fasting in the wilderness, but that it also marks transitional moments in redemptive history that bring an old order to an end and usher in a new beginning. So we've had a pattern in the book of Judges, and in chapter 13, this pattern is going to be broken. Even after 40 years, Israel never cries out for deliverance. So this time, God sends the angel of the Lord, and he comes to a barren woman. There was a certain man of Zorah of the tribe of the Danites whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had no children. And the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, "Behold, you shall conceive and bear a son." The angel goes on to tell her that this son will begin to save Israel. Something is happening with this annunciation, this promise to a barren woman, that will not be fulfilled for over 1,000 years, until the day that the angel Gabriel will come to another woman to announce an impossible pregnancy, to echo the words of Judges 13, "Behold, you will conceive and bear a son," and to tell her that her son will be the ultimate deliverer. In Genesis, God used barrenness as the site of the creation of Israel. In Judges, God uses barrenness as the site of the deliverance of Israel. And then the angel of the Lord says something interesting to the wife of Manoah. He tells her, "Therefore be careful and drink no wine or strong drink and eat nothing unclean. No razor shall come upon his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb." The Nazarite vow is described fully in Numbers 6, and it's a vow for someone to be separated for or consecrated to the Lord. A Nazarite is set apart, made holy before the Lord by three things: separation from wine, strong drink, anything produced by the grapevine, separation from dead bodies, even those of a direct family member, if they were to die while the Nazarite is under their vow, and separation from razors. He shall let the locks of the hair of his head grow long. The Nazarite vow is typically made for a set period of time. Numbers 6 gives instructions on which sacrifices to make once the time of separation has been completed. But with Samson, unusually, it will be for his entire life. Interestingly, the first time the word Nazir is used in the Bible takes us back to Genesis, where Joseph, the son of Rachel, our final barren matriarch, is described by his father Jacob as set apart, Nazir, from his brothers. This idea of the son of a barren woman being particularly set apart or consecrated to God creates a lineage from Joseph to Samson that will be continued, as we'll see, to both Samuel and eventually John the Baptist. Though all of these sons will begin to deliver Israel in their own way, there is only one who will ultimately fulfill and complete that deliverance. The wife of Manoah tells her husband of the angel's message, but Manoah wants to see this man of God himself. Again, the angel appears, and again he appears only to the wife of Manoah. But she runs to bring Manoah, and he asks the angel, "When your words come true, what is to be the child's manner of life and what is his mission?" We might feel a little exasperation with Manoah here. His wife has, after all, told him precisely what the child's manner of life as a Nazirite is to be. But I also think it's possible to have some pity for Manoah. It's clear that a Nazirite vow, with all of its conditions and provisions and consequences for breaking it, cannot be an easy vow to follow for one's entire life. As for the mission to begin to deliver Israel from the Philistines, not a single Israelite in 40 years has asked for this deliverance. How can one man redeem a nation that doesn't want to be redeemed? As we know from the rest of Samson's story, this promised son will be broken in every imaginable way, beaten, mocked, blinded, and eventually broken by death. One can imagine Manoah's hope when he asks the angel to repeat his words. "Perhaps my wife got it wrong. Perhaps the life of our child is not going to be so difficult." We see, after all, the faith of Manoah when he says, "When your words come true." This is not the laughter of Abraham or Sarah, the silence of Rebecca, the rebuking anger of Rachel. Manoah believes the angel's words. He believes a son will be born to his barren wife. He simply hopes that further pain will not follow. What parent would not hope this? When Manoah asks his name, the angel's response is significant. "Why do you ask my name, seeing it is wonderful?" The Hebrew for wonderful is pili, and we see the same root in the next verse. So Manoah offered sacrifice on a rock to the Lord, and the Hebrew reads, "The angel of the Lord did a wondrous thing." Often pili and its root pelah are used in the Old Testament to speak of the works of God that are too great for human understanding. The wonders against the Egyptians in Exodus, the marvels promised to Moses on Sinai. But here, and in Psalm 139, where David sings that we are fearfully and wonderfully made, knit together in our mother's wombs, that the knowledge the Lord has of our lives is too wonderful for us to attain, we see that these wondrous works of God pertain to the conception and the birth of children. We spoke last class about the question that God asks Sarah in Genesis, the question that Brueggemann says is central to human life: is anything too hard for the Lord? We can also ask, in the Hebrew, is anything too wonderful for the Lord? His working of wonders in the life of Sarah, the wife of Manoah, and in Psalm 139 is an aspect of his character that is intimately tied to the creation of life, The ultimate hope, of course, will be found in Isaiah 9:6, when it is prophesied to all of us that a child will be born who will be called Wonderful. A quick side note on Psalm 139. I've had conversations before with friends who have wondered about our miscarried children, those we've lost before the fullness of time. There are a multitude of resources out there, including Held by Abby Wedgeworth and Inheritance of Tears by Jesselyn Hutto, both of whom point to the hope of verse 16. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them. Even before our days begin to be counted, we are written into the Lord's book, known and loved by him. Even if the days that were formed were only a few short weeks in a mother's womb. The finale of this story comes when the angel ascends in the fire of Manoah's sacrifice. Manoah, like Abraham before him, falls to the ground, as does his wife. Manoah speaks fearfully, "We shall surely die, for we have seen God." But his wife speaks instead from a confident assurance. If the Lord had meant to kill us, he would not have accepted the offerings, or shown us all these things, or announced to us such things. 1,000 years later, another young woman will respond to the annunciation of her impossible pregnancy, not with laughter or silence, but with the same humility, strengthened by faith in the word of God. "Lord, let it be to me according to your word." The wife of Manoah is compared to our matriarchs and to her husband, a relatively quiet character. But it is in this quiet reserve that her faith in the angel's promise is treasured and strengthened. When she bears a son, she names him Samson, Hebrew for little son. In the darkness of her barrenness, a light shines. Her son will live a life imbued with so much Christological foreshadowing that he will die with his arms outstretched, betrayed by his own people into the hands of his enemies, and he will die a death that will deliver Israel from the hands of the Philistines. But Israel will fall again, despite Samson's sacrifice. As Samson's story comes to an end, the story of Samuel begins, the boy who will become priest, prophet, and anointer of kings. It is the story of Israel moving from a company of tribes to a monarchy. It is a time, as we saw in Judges, of desperate need and bitterness. Israel's future feels hopeless. Israel's future is barren. And once again, into this barrenness comes a woman. Lillian Klein points out that we learn all we need to know about this woman in a beautiful moment of what English teachers like to call chiasmus. There was a certain man, Elkanah, who had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other, Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. In the first sentence, like Sarah and Rachel before her, Hannah is the beloved wife, placed in the position of primacy. In the second sentence, however, her status is reversed. She is second to Peninnah because, unlike Peninnah, she is barren. We are given some background about the family's annual pilgrimage to Shiloh to sacrifice to God. Elkanah gives Peninnah and all her sons and daughters portions, but he reserves a special portion for Hannah because the Lord has closed her womb. Whether because of jealousy or cruelty, we are told that Peninnah then provokes Hannah. The Hebrew ka'as is the same verb used in the Old Testament for the way that Israel provokes the Lord over and over again. The anger and sorrow that Hannah feels at this provocation is the Hebrew raham, the same word used for the way the voice of the Lord thunders in Job and in the Psalms. This is no light provoking. Penina makes Hannah's life utterly miserable on top of the deep pain she already feels in her barrenness. And this goes on for Hannah year after year after year. We're not told exactly how long, only that it is crushingly repetitive. So much so that as often as they go to Shiloh, Hannah would weep and refuse to eat. Elkanah tries to comfort her, "Am I not more to you than 10 sons?" But as we know from the stories of our other beloved wives like Rebekah and Rachel, the grief of barrenness isn't erased by the power of the husband's love. Hannah can finally endure this no longer. One year she leaves the feast to go to the temple, where she's deeply distressed and weeps bitterly. She does not take her distress out on her husband, as Rachel did to Jacob, or even on Penina, as Sarah did to Hagar. Instead, she turns to Yahweh. She vows a vow that if the Lord will remember her and give her a son, she will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life, and no razor shall touch his head. She will consecrate her son as a Nazarite, one set apart to the Lord. The prayer of remembrance is the same we spoke of last time. When the Lord remembers someone, it's not as if he has forgotten them. Instead, it is a signal that he is about to act, about to spring into salvific action, to move towards redemption. God remembered first Noah, then Abraham, then Rachel. Samson himself, defeated and blinded and crushed by his enemy, calls on God to remember him for one final act of strength to bring down the temple of the Philistines. Hannah's prayer is the same. Remember me. She is calling on a God who upends the world order, who gives strength to the strengthless and life to the dead. It is, I believe, one of the best prayers we can pray. There's a somewhat comical moment when, because she's speaking in her heart, Eli the priest believes Hannah is a drunk. I love the way that the King James translates Hannah's response. "Out of the abundance of my complaint and grief have I spoken." I immediately think of Jesus' words, "Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks." Hannah's heart is overflowing with grief and anguish, and it is from this bitter abundance that she speaks her prayer to God. But God loves prayers of bitter desperation. Eli tells Hannah, "Shalom, the God of Israel grant your petition." "Let your handmaid find favor in your eyes," Hannah responds, a precursor of Mary's words, "Behold, I am the handmaid of the Lord." Hannah returns with Elkanah to Ramah. Elkanah knew his wife, and we're told the Lord remembered her. She conceives and bears Samuel, heard of God. When Hannah returns several years later with the sacrifice of a bull and a flour cake offering, just like Abraham and Manoah, she utters the famous verse of hopeful mothers everywhere. "For this child I have prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition." Strangely enough, though, all the nursery signs on Etsy seem to leave off the rest. "Therefore, I have lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is lent to the Lord." In honoring her vow, Hannah sacrifices her son. Though he lives, he's no longer hers. What has been given, she gives back. Rather than grief or distress, however, we get immediately afterwards one of the most magnificent songs in the Old Testament. One that we'll see next time is the foundation for Mary's Magnificat. Brueggemann notes that barrenness ends by the power of God in glad, trustful worship. Israel's new life emerges out of barrenness by the power of God, inexplicable, irresistible, and that power is evoked, summoned, and triggered by lowly Hannah, who has no virtue, no claim, no capacity, only a stubborn insistence addressed to Yahweh and a readiness to yield back all good gifts. So now, out of the abundance of her heart, she sings, "My heart exults in the Lord." We could spend an entire class on this song alone, and we'll look at it next time alongside Mary's song. But a couple of things to note. Brueggemann notes that the main theme of the song is the power and willingness of Yahweh to intrude, intervene, and invert. So we see familiar reversals. The bows of the mighty are broken, the feeble bind on strength. Those who were full hire themselves for bread. Those who hunger are filled. And here in verse 5, the barren has borne 7, which echoes the reversal that we see in Psalm 113. He gives the barren woman a home, making her the joyous mother of children. I don't think it's an accident that Hannah says the barren has borne 7. Hannah does actually have more children herself later, but she has 6 total, and she hasn't even had them yet when she's singing this song. Instead, her proclamation of praise is a prophecy alongside the other prophecies in this song. We know there are 7 barren women who will bear 7 sons before the ultimate healing that comes with the 8th mother, Mary, and the 8th son, Jesus. Brueggemann writes that Hannah and Israel sing of the one who breaks the power of death. It does not matter if that power is experienced as barrenness, as despair, or as oppression. Hannah flings this song buoyantly in the face of the power of death. Her act is an act of daring hope rooted in a concrete gift waiting for more of life yet to be given. Which takes us to our last woman, the woman of Shunem. Like the wife of Manoah, we don't know her name. She and her family are of little importance, it seems, to Israel's history. Her story is told in chapter 4 of 2 Kings. She's mentioned briefly again in chapter 8, and then she passes out of memory. The two adjectives we're given, gadol, in the Hebrew, and Shunammite, don't give us any much more understanding than that. Shunem is a town in the Jezreel Valley, and gadol is most often translated as great. And most commentators and translators seem to agree this means she's rich, which makes sense. The time of Elisha's ministry is during the decline of Israel after the monarchy to the fall of the first temple in the Babylonian exile. Elisha is the voice of Israel, of Yahweh in Israel, now that the temple has become so corrupted. As he travels around, the woman offers him bread and hospitality, urging him to return. He does so over and over again, and eventually the woman tells her husband they're going to add on a room for Elisha to stay. It's no wonder they call her rich. When Elisha next passes through, he tells his servant Gehazi to call the woman so that he can repay her this kindness. Elisha offers to speak of her to the king or to the captain of hosts, but she refuses. She has her own people, she says. She expresses no needs. She's the hostess, after all. She's got it all together. But it is Gehazi who tells Elisha that she has no children, that her husband is old. So Elisha calls her back. Like Sarah at the tent door, the woman of Shunem stands in the threshold of the room. And the same words that God spoke to Sarah in Genesis 18:10, Elisha speaks to the woman of Shunem. At this season, about this time next year, you shall embrace a son. She has a due date. Like Sarah, the woman's response is one of disbelief. She begs Elisha not to lie to her. For all her hospitality, for all her belief in Elisha as a man of God, she cannot conceive that he has the power to give her the one thing that she wants so desperately, the one thing that no money or status or renovation of her house could ever bring. However, the woman conceived. Despite our circumstances, our inabilities, our disbelief, God works in the however. God conceives in the emptiness. But this beautiful promise that has just been given is then ripped away in the span of 3 verses. We are told he has grown, but the narrative continues to refer to him as a child, so he's likely an adolescent. He is out in the field with his father when he begins to complain about his head. His concerned father has him carried to his mother at the house, where we are told he sat on her lap till noon, and then he died. Though sparse, there's a vividness to this picture of the grief and the great tragedy of this moment. What has been given so freely and graciously has now been cruelly ripped away. But strangely, the woman does not sit and weep. Instead, she takes her boy up and lays him on Elisha's bed, closing the door on his body and leaving the house. She calls for a donkey, and when her husband questions her, she says nothing but shalom, peace, it is well. When Elisha on Mount Carmel sees her coming, he sends Gehazi to ask her, shalom with you, shalom with your husband, shalom with a child. Her response, shalom, it is well. Where does this upwelling of shalom come from, we wonder? How can the death of the boy she longed for and loved so much be shalom? She throws herself at the feet of Elisha, not in grief, but in a claim on the power of God. Did I ask my Lord for a son, she says. Did I not say, do not deceive me? Her posture may be supplication, but her words are invocation. She is calling on Elisha to remember his promise. She is calling on the man of God to remember his promise. There's another woman in Luke 8 who falls to her feet in supplication before Jesus as he moves through the crowd, reaching out just to touch the hem of his cloak. She asks nothing, entreats nothing. She simply sees the presence of God, reaches out, and grabs hold of his power. Instantly, she is healed. Daughter, Jesus tells her, your faith has made you well. Shalom. The woman of Shunem is reaching for that same power. But this is a significant shift from the woman who told Elisha, do not lie to your servant. Her faith, we now see, comes on the other side of grace. By healing her womb, God has also given her a new heart. The woman who was so utterly independent that she needed nothing is now in the posture of complete dependency. When Elisha shuts himself in the room with the child, she waits outside, passively, dependently. Elijah performs a similar miracle in 1 Kings when he raises the son of a widow from the dead. In that scene, the widow tells Elijah that by this act she knows that he's a man of God and that the word of the Lord in his mouth is true. But the woman of Shunem has no need for these words. She knows the truth of the Lord's words already. She can claim the power of resurrection now because she herself has already been resurrected. From barrenness to motherhood, from independence to dependence, from the closed fist to the open palm. Writing back again of Hannah's song, Brueggemann says that it begins in barrenness redeemed. Barrenness, however, is the penultimate humiliation. The last threat is death. And the best, most astonishing gift is resurrection life. The sons of our first two barren women today began to deliver Israel at specific moments in Israel's history. But it is the Shunammite boy, the power of his mother's faith, stemming from the inconceivable gift of barrenness reversed, the last of our barren women in the Old Testament, who illustrates the pattern to come. God has begun his plan of deliverance at the site of the barren womb, but he is not finished. And the fulfillment of this plan will bring the greatest reversal the world has ever seen. Hope to the hopeless, strength to the weak, life to the dead. Barrenness will be nothing in the face of this. Thank you.
You've been listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. If you live in Birmingham or find yourself visiting, we hope you'll join us for one of our Sunday services. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.